From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. As February marks Black History Month, we take a closer look at the history of the civil rights struggle in the Sunshine State, from the Reconstruction era to desegregation, and the civil rights movement of the 60s and modern day. Florida's history in the Black freedom struggle includes stories that run the spectrum from disturbing to inspiring. Our guests today share their historical expertise and some of their own remembrances. We'll also take a closer look at an exhibit titled Civil Rights in the Sunshine State that opened at the Museum of Florida History in Tallahassee in 2014 to mark the 50th anniversary of the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. That exhibit is now on display at the Southwest Florida Museum of History in Fort Myers and includes some photos and other artifacts specific to the struggle for civil rights here in Southwest Florida. First, this news. From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. February marks Black History Month. Today we focus on the civil rights struggle in the Sunshine State and here in Southwest Florida. We begin back in the Reconstruction era following the end of the Civil War, moving all the way through to desegregation and the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Political and business leaders in Florida worked hard to create the perception that Florida was more temperate when it came to race relations than its fellow southern states, but historians challenge that perception. From the 1890s to the 1930s, Florida had the highest per capita rate of lynchings by white mobs, including the infamous Rosewood Massacre of 1923 in Central Florida. Many historic moments in the struggle for racial equality were met with great resistance in Florida, including the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court decision on desegregating schools and the signing of the Voting Rights Act in 1964, which barred discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, and national origin. The 50-year anniversary of that landmark civil rights legislation was marked in Florida in 2014 with an exhibit on the history of the civil rights movement in the Sunshine State. It was first housed in the Museum of Florida History in Tallahassee. It's now on display at the Southwest Florida Museum of History in Fort Myers, where it will remain till June 11th. Joining me now is Michelle Hearn. She's senior curator at the Museum of Florida History and was largely responsible for creating the exhibit. Michelle Hearn, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined in studio by Dr. Irvin Winsborough. He's a professor of history at Florida Gulf Coast University with expertise in African-American history, civil rights protests, and Florida history and culture. He's written many books and scholarly articles on the civil rights movement, including Old South, New South, or Down South, Florida and the Modern Civil Rights Movement, which won the Harry T. and Harriet V. Moore Book Award, named for Florida's first civil rights martyr family. Winsborough also has written Florida's Freedom Struggle, The Black Experience from Colonial Time to the New Millennium, which won the Stetson Kennedy Book Award, named after Florida's nationally acclaimed civil rights investigative journalist. Dr. Winsborough, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and may I say thank you to my colleague Michelle up in Tallahassee as well.
All right. I love
it's
it when
nice
everybody
to hear your voice.
Yeah, I love it when everybody knows each other already. It makes it easy.
John, if I may, I'd like to compliment you on that very incisive introduction.
Well, thank you. We'll get more in depth here now. I invite and listeners to connect with our guests as well. You can call 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Dr. Winsborough, I wanted to begin with you. First, take us back to the Reconstruction era in Florida following the Civil War. You know, the sting of defeat would linger, of course, for generations. And then in 1865, the Democratic-controlled state legislature passed black codes to limit the voting rights of African Americans. Can you give us an idea or a picture of, you know, what the black experience would have been like for this newly freed population?
Yes, John. I'll do my best to answer that question. First, in terms of Reconstruction, we'll set the premise that Florida was not unlike its Confederate allies, its Confederate neighbors, former Confederate neighbors, I should say, in following Reconstruction and seeking to recreate the racial oppression that occurred in the state, the southern state, deep southern state, prior to the Civil War. Now, having said that, Florida entered Reconstruction by moved to some very liberal political ground, uncommonly in that era. Excuse me, I have a somewhat bit of a sore throat today. during Reconstruction and followed the pattern of most former Confederate states. However, Florida, unlike other Confederate states, generally departed Reconstruction, and that was orchestrated by the conservative Bourbons. The conservative Bourbons, and generally in the early 18, not generally, but in the early 1870s. Most historians mark the end of Reconstruction as 1876. In fact, Florida departed its liberal experiment with at least racial and social progress during the time of Reconstruction by the early 1870s. Again, that was orchestrated by the conservative Bourbons, the plutocrats, the Bourbons in the state. By the election, the pivotal election, the contested Hayes-Tilden election of 1876, Florida had already reinstituted its racially oppressive codes that characterized the state as they did most deep Southern states prior to the Civil War. So the experiment was over in Florida by the early 1870s. I throw out those dates not to confuse any of those listeners, but to give you sort of a timeline, because there was a constitution and a new constitution in Florida in 1868 that provided for very liberal progressive measures, especially in terms of education, but they were all to be segregated. Even the Constitution of 1868, during right in the throes of Reconstruction, called for separate schools and separate accommodations as well. That was reconfirmed in the Constitution of 1885. The new Constitution of 1885, and then reconfirmed in other constitutions, state constitutions, that is, all the way down through the 1960s and 1970s. I would like to talk about that, but only if you or your listeners would like me to go.
Please, yes, go ahead.
Well, okay, well, thank you. Thank you. I didn't want to stray too far away from Reconstruction.
Sure.
But thank you, because I think it's significant. We've set the preface by talking about Reconstruction and the reconstitution of the racially oppressive codes that characterized Florida actually, all of the states in the Deep South, including Florida, I might add, coming into the 1960s and 1970s. That lead-in, I think, is propitious, the lead-in that you shared with us at the beginning of this segment in terms of Brown versus Board, because most people who aren't familiar or deeply familiar with the history of Florida think that Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, the landmark Supreme Court decision, they called for the end of segregation in public schools, I might add. Desegregated schools in Florida, it did not. And neither did Brown versus Board II in 1955. They called for the desegregation of school with all due speed. In Florida, in fact, the pattern was all due impede. Florida did not desegregate its schools generally across the state until the late 1960s and 1970s. Some of the younger listeners might think that's ancient history when the troglodytes walked the earth. I guess the troglodytes actually walked the caves, but I think that's ancient history. But some of us can remember that, and certainly parents and grandparents of the younger generation today can remember that. That is not ancient history. In fact, John, and this includes Lee County. In fact, by 1969, 1970, two-thirds of the school districts in the state of Florida were still segregated. Two-thirds of the school districts were still segregated. 90% of black students in Florida went to segregated schools as late as 1969 and 1970. What finally brought about the desegregation of schools, public schools, that is, in Florida, was the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that included Title IV and Title VI, which called for the federal government, the attorney general, to be allowed to enter on the side of plaintiffs in suing school districts to end biracial school districts and biracial school policies and so forth. So I stress that because, again, 1969, 1970, when Florida finally, under court order, including Lee County, John, finally moved to desegregation, forced desegregation, mm-hmm. was not, at least in my opinion, my humble opinion, was not ancient history. Now, the second part of that I wanted to thank you for the lead-in is, in fact, in many cases, journalists, laypersons, and even some historians and scholars have argued that Florida, in fact, was ahead of the curve, not behind the curve in terms of desegregation. That is not correct. Florida was just as solidly a segregationist state as any other of the states of the Deep South. Now, John, you were very perceptive in pointing out that very perceptive, I might add, in pointing out at the outset of this segment that many laypersons and scholars have seen Florida as a moderate state, that is to say moderate in terms of race relations. And in fact, it was scholars call this exceptionalism. And Florida was not an exceptional state. Florida was a congruent state in terms of its policies, its racial policies and practices and codes with all of the other states of the Deep South. You mentioned to me once in one of our discussions, past discussions, about St. Augustine. I don't know if we have time today to discuss that.
Sure.
I'll leave that up to you, but I think that would be indicative of what you and I have been developing in terms of Florida not being a moderate or an exceptional state. And in fact, this is the premise that underlies my two books, Old South, New South, or Down South, Florida and the Modern Civil Rights Movement, published by West Virginia University Press, and Florida's Freedom Struggle, published by Florida Historical Society Press. That Florida was not a moderate, it was not an exceptional state when it came to race relations, and it was not – excuse me, and may, I hope your listeners excuse me too. Pardon me, I have a sore throat today. You and I have talked in the past, and we talked about St. Augustine. In fact, St. Augustine was one of the bloodiest incidents of civil rights throughout the South, not just in Florida, but throughout the South. This occurred in 1964 when St. Augustine was getting ready to celebrate its 500-year centennial of its founding in 1565 by Pedro de Avilés de Mendez in 1565. And African-Americans protested that, and the local African-American leader, and I think Michelle could speak about this better than I, Dr. Haling, invited – Michelle is very conversant with this, and she's really an expert. We're so happy she's here to join us. Then Dr. Haling asked Dr. King to move his Southern Christian Leadership Conference crusades to St. Augustine. Just to encapsulate this, to make this long story very short, and it is a long story, Dr. King moved it. Took his protest movement to St. Augustine, and he found it to be so bloody and the racist of St. Augustine to be so vicious that he termed it an even worse protest experience for him than Birmingham, than under Bull Connor in Birmingham in 1963, Alabama. It was even in his recollections he wrote that it was one of the worst civil rights experiences of his years. Of course, he died. He was assassinated in 1968, of his years of protest. And, you know, if Michelle is there, she's really, really conversant with Dr. Haling, who just died recently. She'd be kind enough to sort of piggyback onto what I've suggested.
Weigh in.
Well, actually, I just went to Dr. Haling's memorial service on this weekend, and I saw Andrew Young recalling the days back in St. Augustine when all that was going on. What Dr. Haling's been called the father of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, because that movement in St. Augustine was so important to pressuring the Congress, which was filibustering at the time, into the passage of that act. Dr. Haling, you know, he was from Tallahassee, and he came from a very nice family. He was very well educated in the military. And he had a successful biracial dental practice in St. Augustine. And he could have led a very easy life there, but he chose to become involved and stand up for what was right. And he led this group. He became involved in the NAACP, and he led this group of young the Youth Council, and he led the proactive actions there to protest the segregation and for the students that were arrested were minors, and they were pressured to sign a complaint against Dr. Haling that he had contributed to their delinquency, which would have been a felony. And they refused to do it, and they were sent away for 6 months to reform school. The two boys were actually sent to the Dozier School of Boys, which is now notorious. Mm. But so the two ladies actually still live in St. Augustine. The violence was ratcheting up. His house was shot into. He was beaten. He was severely beaten at a Klan meeting. He lost like 13 teeth. He permanently damaged his hand.
Broke his fingers to try to prevent him from going back to his dental practice.
Right. And they were saved because there was a white progressive man in the audience who had contacted the sheriff's department in Tallahassee to come – the State Department to come and get him. but his dog was killed. There were bombings. There was a bombing of a car of children who had tried to integrate the school. And the NAACP became uncomfortable, and they asked Haling to resign and other members of the local NAACP chapter to resign. So he got in his car and he went to Orlando, where the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was meeting, and he asked them to come to St. Augustine and help. And they decided that their summer campaign was going to be in St. Augustine. And people came from – activists came from other parts of the country to help. The mother of the governor of Massachusetts was actually arrested in St. Augustine trying to integrate a restaurant with Dr. Haling at the Munson Motor Lodge. 16 rabbis came. They were arrested. It was the largest arrest of rabbis in American history. And Dr. King himself on June 18th was arrested. And it was a firestorm. This was on TV nationally, day in and day out. It was on TV. And this pressure helped lead to the passage of the Civil Rights Act. And so it's just this one person. It was lots of people. There are lots of foot soldiers in St. Augustine. So it wasn't really one person. But Dr. Haling's example and his commitment, his bravery really helped change the whole country, not just in Florida, but this had a major impact on the whole nation. And people don't really remember now that this was on TV every day. Some swimmers the day Dr. King was arrested at the Munson Motor Lodge tried to jump into the pool and integrate the pool. And yes, the James Brock, the motel manager, kind of flipped out and he poured this muriatic acid into the pool to try to get them out. Now, it doesn't really hurt people, but it was the gesture. And this was photographed and it was all over newspapers all over America the next day when the Civil Rights Act was actually passed.
Well, I wanted to play a quick audio clip here, and this is from WGCU's Jessica Mazzaro's interview recently with Elena Geyer. She's curator at the Southwest Florida Museum of History. And this is regarding sort of a similar issue in St. Augustine, only this time it's not integrating a pool. It was integrating public beaches. Let's go ahead and hear that now.
Think of the civil rights movement, because you always think of like Selma, or you think of Birmingham, or you think of places not in Florida, and you know you don't normally think of beach images, right? So we actually have quite a few images of segregated beaches and of wade-ins, which you don't you like civil rights movement. You don't think of wade-ins; you think of sit-ins. But we also had wade-ins in Florida, where black people tried to integrate with the white beaches, and there. So I think that's just it's a fun twist on the civil rights movement, and it gives it a very Florida feel because that is something that like. It never even occurred to me that they were, you know, integrating the beaches as well, because of course there were black and white beaches, but you don't automatically think of that.
Can you describe some of the images that we're looking at?
Well, we have some images of the black beaches, Butler Beach, which was in the St. Augustine area. And so, you know, people who are just having a great time at the black beach, but, you know, they know, you know, that it's segregated. So at least they felt safe because they didn't have to worry about you know, white people trying to attack them. But then we have the next images when the black people in the 60s were trying to integrate the beaches of black men being told by a police officer to leave. And it's a very confrontational picture. So it really just shows that they had a lot of bravery to be able to go to the beach and try. And it's a very good picture as well.
What exactly is in the image for those who can't see?
We have 5 black men in swim trunks, and they are being told by a police officer, by two police officers, to leave. And you have the officer pointing his finger away from the water, and you can see that they, you know, they're trying to tell him, like, just let us do this, and he's, you know, not having any of it. But I think it's a very, it's a great picture. Not just because the men are attractive, no.
And it is a white police officer.
It is a white police officer, absolutely. So, and this particular picture was in Fort Lauderdale, actually. So they were trying, but sadly, I know that I've seen some pictures with the Florida Memory Project of attempts in St. Augustine to integrate the beaches, and their actual brawls between blacks and whites, and you have white women attacking black women, and it's very violent images. And we don't have those here in this exhibit, but you could easily find them online. But I think that those are truly some of the most terrifying images, really, of the wade-in efforts.
And in terms of those weighed-in efforts, is that something that primarily happened like in the St. Augustine area, or was it really throughout coastal Florida?
It was throughout coastal Florida. Some of the earliest civil rights activities were weighed-ins. There was some in the 1940s in Miami relating to the Virginia – you know, when Virginia Beach Key was established as a black beach. That was because they were trying to integrate in the 1940s another all-white beach in Miami. In Fort Lauderdale, what she's talking about, that was actually an NAACP action led by the woman president, Eula Johnson, in that area. So, I mean, it didn't just happen in Florida. This happened all over America. But some of the earliest weighed-in actions were in Florida.
We're exploring the history of civil rights in Florida with FGCU history professor Dr. Irvin Winsboro, along with Michelle Hearn, senior curator at the Museum of Florida History. Listeners can connect with our guests by calling 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live or comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media.
And if I may.
Yes, please, Michelle.
Thank you. One of the interesting things about this exhibit is that it has a statewide perspective. Mm-hmm. And not a lot of work has been done on that. One of the few works are the two books that Dr. Winsboro was talking about that he has edited, and then also Dr. Paul Ortiz's book, Emancipation Betrayed. These are some of the few examples of really trying to think of Florida, the whole state of Florida, and trying to think about its role in the civil rights movement. A lot of work's been done in other states, but it's been very limited here. And the exhibit in Fort Myers right now is really trying to do that, trying to look at the whole state.
And is the exhibit itself, are there a lot of artifacts involved? Is it very, I guess, photograph heavy?
Well, that just depends on where it is. When it was up here, we had artifacts from all over the state, St. Augustine, Jacksonville, Miami, that we borrowed. Now, we couldn't travel those with the exhibit because they were borrowed. So it's up to other – when the exhibit comes, it's up to other institutions to supplement the exhibit.
Sure.
The exhibit also comes with three different videos. It comes with historic oral histories of people talking about remembering the civil rights movement and the things they went through, and also audio from the time period. So it has a lot of different aspects, not just – images.
Sure. And did you want to say something, Dr. Winsboro?
No, I was just going to add to what Michelle said. She was talking about Virginia Key Beach in the Miami area. Another beach would have been Amelia Beach. But scholars call this places of public space, and the racially contested areas for places of public space includes not only beaches but public parks, fairgrounds, and places of that nature, places of public space of that nature as well. And I would add, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't add that the expert in Florida on that is Gregory Bush at the University of Miami.
All right. And Michelle, I just wanted to ask you, in terms of putting this exhibit together, has it impacted your own perspective on the civil rights struggle? Was there any particular, you know, piece of information or artifact that you came across that was just particularly standout or surprising?
Well, I didn't know very much in the beginning of this process about civil rights in Florida. So a lot of things that Dr. Winsboro talked about were new to me and amazed me and amazed a lot of the audience, like the idea that Florida was not an exception. Florida had the highest per capita lynching rate from 1890 to 1930. Florida, with 40% of its population enslaved on the eve of the Civil War, was the third state to secede. A lot of people don't know about that. The other thing, the flip side of that, is a lot of people, because that history was sort of covered up or glossed over, they don't understand that Florida played an important role in the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. The first sit-in in the South was in Miami before Greensboro. The jail over bail tactic during the student movement was pioneered in Tallahassee. And again, the importance of St. Augustine's movement. So that other history was covered up, too, in the process. The other thing that really surprised me was how far back activism goes. When in 1901, 1905, they passed laws boycotting. Basically, they said streetcars had to be segregated. And African Americans boycotted streetcars way back in 1901 and 1905, long before, you know, Montgomery happened in the 50s. So I did not understand that African Americans had never been satisfied with less than full citizenship in Florida, and they had been continuously organizing all these generations for their full rights as citizens. So those were some of the things that really I really learned about.
All right. I wanted to play just another brief clip from our interview with Southwest Florida History Museum curator Elena Geyer. And here she's describing another powerful image included in the exhibit.
Another very telling image is we have pictures of the KKK in Florida. And it's just, it's very scary. You see like the burning crosses and I feel fear when I look at that. And I can only imagine what the people living in that time period, if they saw that, what they must have felt. Because it's just a very haunting image.
What can you describe the image? So what exactly are we looking at? The people, location?
Honestly, the thing that always stands out to me in this one particular picture in this panel is that it's a couple. It's a man and a woman. The man is in his white robe and he's holding his girlfriend's hand. So obviously, you know, he loves someone, yet he has so much hate in his heart as he looks at a burning cross and like admiration. And it's just such a weird scene to think that like, oh, that was your date night going to a Ku Klux Klan, you know, burning cross rally. But it's, you know, that it was just so ingrained in these KKK members like psyche that they just felt that they could, you know, that this was so normal that they could just have this much hate in them. So that's really what is the most, you know, telling picture to me.
Dr. Winsborough?
Yeah, I think that punctuates some of the themes that Michelle was developing earlier. Let me go back a little bit and add that Florida was also the first state in terms of disfranchising African Americans to institute the Grandfather Clause back in the 1890s. It was the very first state to do that. Florida was the last state to have what is implicit in this just prior discussion, the last of the great what has been described by scholars as the last of the great spectator lynchings. That occurred in Florida. And let me tell you listeners as well, to my dismay and probably theirs, that that occurred to servicemen, black servicemen, returning in the time of war, World War II. They were lynched in their uniform because they had come home and wanted to be served and wanted to be treated equally. And this state was not ready to do that. And in fact, Florida was the second last state behind Alabama to eliminate the convict labor lease system as well. So these are all aspects of Florida history that, as Michelle pointed out earlier, seemed to somehow or another gotten lost, stolen, or strayed, somehow or another submerged in the history of this, of the, not only Florida, but in the history of the South as well.
Can either of you speak to maybe why lynchings were as prevalent as they were in Florida? I mean, they certainly occurred in other southern states as well, but it seemed like it was a particularly big problem here.
Well, one reason was that lynching was a means of social control, first of all. And because of Florida's labor system, the white business community of Florida did not want African Americans to leave the state to head north, especially at the time of the Great Migration. So lynching was a form of intimidation as well to, quote unquote, keep blacks, keep African Americans in their place, but primarily Florida didn't want to, it was used to intimidate. Florida didn't want to lose its black debt peonage labor pool, and it was one reason that it was so high in Florida. But remember, in Florida, that was per capita. That is not absolving the other states of lynching either. That is per capita.
Right.
And Florida has that dubious record.
What about the the infamous Rosewood Massacre in 1923.
Yeah, and it was infamous. That's a good descriptor for it. But that followed on the heels of the Ocoee Massacre in 1920. And most people who haven't studied Florida in depth don't even recognize the word Ocoee. There was one that occurred in Ocoee in 1920 that was just as violent and just as bloody as the one that occurred in Rosewood. I think most of our listeners probably recognize Rosewood because it was it later became a very hot political football in Florida, and there was remuneration paid to some of the few Rosewood survivors. But also, it was written into a book and then made into a movie as well. So the name seems to be much more common. But let me bring you up just forward a little bit, if I may. Those were not the only bloody incidents.
Sure.
There, you know, we talked about St. Augustine, but there were race riots in 1960 and 1964 in Jacksonville as well, very serious race riots as well. There were race riots in Pensacola. There were race riots in Tallahassee. And I think some of your listeners might even be able to remember back to the 1980s and 1990s when the racial disturbances occurred in St. Petersburg and in Overtown and Liberty City of Miami as well. So we talk about history, but we need to put that – look at our historical lens and focus that and put all of that into perspective as well.
Right, right. And Michelle, I know you said that you had learned a lot putting this exhibit together. And, you know, there's a lot of the violence that we know occurred has been well documented in images. Did you come across photographs or, you know, I know lynching photographs even became postcards. People would send them to each other. I mean, did you come across things that you felt were very powerful but maybe were just too gruesome in some way to include?
No, I definitely did. Like we did, we went out of our way not to candy coat or whitewash the history. Mm. But at the same time, we get thousands and thousands of children that come through our museum. So we do have lynching pictures up in the state archives. Mm-hmm. Those are not online, but they do exist. It was for my personal decision, I decided that if I had been lynched, I wouldn't want people to look at the pictures.
Right.
And it was just for my personal position, it was just a matter of taste. That's the same reason, and these are controversial. Different people have different opinions about this, but we did not show full regalia Klan outfits. We did not want to in any way glorify the Klan. Now, mm-hmm. we did have the Klan items. They were smaller items. We had patches from a Pensacola Klan, and we had a stamp of the ladies of the Ku Klux Klan from Crescent City. Which showed the involvement of women. It showed different people in Klan members in different parts of the state. But those are some of the things that we had to grapple with. This is a very contested history. It's a very sensitive history. And one of the ways but we did not want to do some kind of, you know, lightweight African American first exhibit. We wanted to seriously grapple with the topic.
Right, right.
And so one of the ways we dealt with that was we reached out and formed relationships with scholars and institutions across the state. We worked with over 30 different scholars and 15 different institutions in trying to show different perspectives and really really do a deep analysis. And, you know, people – this is a living history. People remember the civil rights movement. And so you're dealing with an academic history and you're dealing with popular memory. And one of the interesting things is when people came to the exhibit, they would start to tell their own stories and what they remembered. And that was really like – and that's kind of an advanced function of a museum. It's like we're creating this shared history together and we're exploring history together and creating our identity and together and remembering where we came from and – how that affects us going forward. So it was an extremely emotional experience for everyone. And it was an emotional exhibit. I mean, people cried in the exhibit. So
yeah,
it was a lot.
All right. And Dr. Winsborough?
Just by way of peroration, I'd like to point out to your listeners that when we talk about lynching, the number of lynchings in Florida and the South, those are reported lynchings, John. Those don't necessarily represent the actual number of lynchings in the South. How did I learn this? When I did way back in my younger days, when I was researching the NAACP papers at the National Archives in Washington, D.C., I came across folder after folder after folder of articles from newspapers and notes that had been written for African Americans in the South who didn't have writing skills and they were marked with X and so forth about how their family, their friends, or their neighbors had been lynched and they were afraid to report it because of the intimidation, losing their jobs and so forth. So you think about the number of lynchings that have been reported and so forth. From my experience and my research, I have to share with you and your listeners that I think that is grossly, grossly underrepresented because, once again, those with only the officially recorded lynchings, not those that people experienced in the South, African Americans, and to the point at which they're actually intimidated, afraid to report those. I think this is something that needs to be looked at in the historical record very closely one of these days.
Wow, that's very interesting and very sad.
It is very interesting and very sad.
Well, I want to throw our final question out for this segment to Michelle. And just generally speaking, what do you want museum patrons to take away from experiencing this?
Well, I really think it's important that we have these cultural exchanges. when you look at this deep, we went back and we looked at the deep history following Dr. Ortiz's example. He starts at the end of Reconstruction. We went all the way past the kind of the traditional end of the Civil Rights Movement, which some people date with the passage of the Civil Rights Act or the death of Dr. King. We went into the urban rioting and the forced busing and the white backlash and all that. And what we really want people is to look at the deep history and kind of think about how the concepts of justice, race, democracy have evolved and what we mean when we say these things and who's included. And, you know, kind of this long analysis, and it really is intricate. It's very deep in what our identity is as Floridians, as Americans. So, and just to continue the conversation. I mean, that's the role of museums, really, is to create a place, a public space, as Dr. Winsborough said, for conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the program. But thanks so much to my guests, FGCU History Professor Dr. Irvin Winsborough. Thanks for speaking
with
us.
Bye, Dr. Winsborough.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also, thanks to Michelle Hearn. She's Senior Curator at the Museum of Florida History. She created the Civil Rights in the Sunshine State exhibit, currently on display at the Southwest Florida Museum of History in downtown Fort Myers. That exhibit runs through June 11. Thanks so much, Michelle Hearn, for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, our conversation on civil rights in the Sunshine State continues with a closer focus on civil rights history here in Southwest Florida. That's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. As February marks Black History Month, today we're exploring the history of the civil rights movement in Florida. For the remainder of the hour, we'll take a closer look at the civil rights struggle here in Southwest Florida and what remains to be accomplished. Joining me now is longtime Fort Myers resident and civil rights activist Willie Green. Green is a former NAACP Lee County Chapter President and Southern Christian Leadership Conference local chapter president. He's also started the Justice for All People Foundation. Willie Green, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we're also joined by Jared Eady. He's board chair of the Lee County Black History Society. Thanks for your time today as well.
Thank you so much, John. We appreciate it.
And you can connect with our guests with a phone call to 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or join our live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Willie Green, I wanted to begin with you. Tell us first about your personal experience coming to Fort Myers in 1953, I believe.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes, I grew up in Miami, of course, and graduated from school in 1952, and I got married in 53. And I come from a real large family, and I figured this was a place to come compete with my father to raise a big family, a large family. And, of course, I grew up in the agriculture business, and this was nothing but agriculture then. And it attracted my attention, and from 1953 through 1959, I literally lived in Fort Myers and went back to Miami on the weekend. The wife refused to make Fort Myers her home at that time. Mm-hmm. So I got involved in civil rights prior to graduating from school. With the NAACP Youth Council down in Dade County, at that time the Miami branch. And, of course, I found so many things that we had already fought for and somewhat corrected still existing in Fort Myers. So
yeah.
The struggle continues.
Yeah, I mean, you come here and it's, you've got two all-white schools, one in Fort Myers, one in North Fort Myers, and then there's the one all-black school in Dunbar.
Correct.
You had, Lee Memorial Hospital was for white patients, and then there was the Jones Walker for blacks. And
right.
I mean, you still had this very entrenched institutional segregation.
Correct.
And going back and forth between here and Miami, did you kind of feel like Fort Myers was
a bit
behind?
I kind of felt like I was going from one country to another.
Mm.
Yeah. There was no resemblance that Fort Myers was all part of Florida. It was so backward in every way. And, I mean, such thing as you couldn't even go downtown, minorities or blacks, as we were. We really hadn't got to be blacks. Then we was Negroes. And Negroes could not go downtown after 6 o'clock in the evening unless they had a permit of some sort from someone who they worked for down there. You couldn't just walk down there.
And how would you characterize racial relations when it came to law enforcement? I read about a particularly memorable run-in you had with a sheriff in a segregated black neighborhood a few years after you'd moved here and gotten involved with the local NAACP. Right. Tell us about that.
Actually, the sheriff, and of course it was no different with the chief of police, had a unwritten rule that the black officers could not arrest a white person, and of course, this mean that if you were in the Dunbar era and you had a reason to have a confrontation with the white person would simply look at the police officer and say, "Go to hell, boy," and walk away. And of course, the sheriff. I started a newspaper because I was always kind of been in the forefront of fighting, so I started up a newspaper called the Ebony Star. And I started circulating it around the state, and I started to beat up on the sheriff, who was Snag Thompson then. We finally become friends, of course. And of course, I guess Burl Underhill was the chief of police. And I had made a few dollars along the way. And I went down to Miami and I bought myself a new Cadillac. Yeah, and as soon as I drove on to what is now Martin Luther King, it was Anderson Avenue, there was somebody who apparently either told, because I didn't see a police, but either told them, because the police came from the opposite direction. They were headed east and I was headed west. And I turned on the high street because I had bought property over in that area. And I was literally going to my property. There were no houses on it, but I was going to my property. And they pulled me over. I wind up, first of all, I guess I was a little smart at the mouth because the police asked me, he asked me what was in my pocket. I said, whatever it is that belonged to me. And of course, on the handcuffs went, and when he fell in my pocket, I had $2,000 or $3,000. And he asked me what I was doing with that much money. I said, I'm a professional hustler. Well, that got me the city. They had a city jail in.
Oh, wow.
That got me. They charged me with giving false information to a police officer. There was nothing false about that. That's what I had. But anyway, the following morning it got dropped, and of course then it wound up in a lawsuit. And finally, I let them know that I was here to stay, and I wasn't going to be pushed around. And really, Snag and I became the best of friends. He was a farmer, and of course I was in the agriculture business. As a matter of fact, I used to farm where we were sitting here. This used to be my farm, but I used to grow sod here. And before Ben Hill Griffin decided to donate it.
I see.
So it was a lot of excitement. I was just telling Brother Edie as we sit outside about some of the things that happened. And you get to the place that where you expect it. So it's like an everyday occurrence. And if I make it through the day, then I'll thank the Lord and I'll try for another day. And it was a lot of killings was taking place around the country. We had lost in 52. We had lost our state president and his wife on Christmas Eve Day. And that goes a little bit later. We lose Mayor Grevers up in Mississippi. So it was Cheney and Goodman in Mississippi. So it was a lot of reasons to fear. But then I just remembered that you cannot ever let fear stop you from doing what you got to do, because if you don't do it, at least you will have went doing something. I say that to people even till the day. Don't worry about fear, because there are lots of people that just standing on the street doing nothing and they get killed. So at least I was trying to make things different.
Well, we talked in the first portion of the program about, a lot of the intense violence that people face just for trying to integrate public spaces, restaurants, beaches. I mean, surely in your own activism, you've faced some intense hate or threats or intimidation. I mean, did you ever fear for your own life, and kind of what kept you going?
As I told Brother Edie earlier, I thought about it because I come from a large family, and I have a large family. I had 10 children. And at the time I was doing that, seven of the 10 were very small. They were living in my household. And obviously, you think about, as Martin said, you would love to see your little children grow up in an atmosphere or environment that was safe and fair and a level playing field. But then if you get killed, at least they will know, like my children know, that my father gave his best, and they'll go on. And so you get past the fear. You can't do it if you're afraid, because I mentioned to him I've had shake hands with the Ku Klux Klan and what have you. You know, you get past it. And, of course, the worst hurt that I've ever got physically were not here, was in Miami. I got the scars. I keep them up there. Got to where I could have had plastic surgery and have it all removed. I kept them for my memories of where we were and where we came from.
Yeah, you were impressed.
This happened in Miami. Got that ball busted up there. It's a steel plate there.
Hmm.
Yeah. Happened with a horse. We was integrating Dairy Queen. Back in those days, you could go to the Dairy Queen and buy your ice cream, but you couldn't sit down in the patio. So my group had the youth, which was actually Miami Youth Council. We had had enough. And we bought the cream, sit down to eat it. And they had posses back in those days, and the guys cops rode horses, and that's what happened.
Jeez.
So you kind of, each incident give you a little more strength.
Man.
And a little more. Yeah. We sang a song, "Yield Not to Temptation, for yielding is sin. Each victory will help you another one to win."
Right. Well said. Well, and Jared Eady, I wanted to bring you into the conversation. Just first of all, tell us a bit about the Black History Society here in Lee County and your work and mission.
Sure. Thanks, John, for the question. The Lee County Black History Society was started to just do what we're doing now, to preserve a lot of these great stories, like Mr. Willie Green, who are profiles in Courage in our local community for the wonderful works that they've done over the years. The museum has been open since 2001, and we're celebrating our 15th anniversary of the Lee County Black History Society and the Williams Academy Black History Museum. So our purpose is to make sure that these stories don't go to the wayside, and that the next generation of our citizens, without regard to color, understand that they're profiles of courage. We don't have to look to national history. We have local history like Mr. Willie Green and now the late, great Dr. Veronica Shoemaker, who stood in the gap, who were wonderful profiles of courage.
Fantastic. Yeah. I know the rededication ceremony for the Williams Academy Black History Museum is coming up on Saturday. Can you just speak a little bit to the historical significance of the Williams Academy?
Sure. The Williams Academy building now that serves as our museum is the 1942 addition to Williams Primary. Williams Primary and Williams Academy was constructed in the 1912-1913 school year, and it was the first government-funded school for African-American children here in Southwest Florida, Lee County, Fort Myers specifically. Prior to that, Mr. Nelson Tillis, a notable name, who was the first permanent settler here of color in Fort Myers, he did establish a school for his children on his property. But Williams Academy was constructed and named after Mr. J.S. Williams, who was the superintendent of the colored schools at that time. So that facility educated the children in this community until Dunbar High School was constructed in 1927. The Lee County Black History Society acquired the structure in 1995 and moved it to its current location. So it's just so great to see that structure still standing as a testament to the unshakable commitment to educational attainment by our local citizens and because of people like Mr. Willie Green who fought to make sure that that building was moved to Clemente Park in 1995, and also the money that was required to make sure it was renovated to its once splendor and glory was secured. So now those of us who are still there are the gatekeepers and griots of that legacy.
Well, in the first portion of our program here, we touched on, you know, major events in the civil rights movement like, you know, Brown versus Board of Education, Supreme Court decision, the 1964 Voting Rights Act being signed into law. And I was reading a news press article that came out on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Voting Rights Act, sort of looking at different people's remembrances of that. And it kind of seemed like in you know, the white side of town, it was just another day. But in the Dunbar community, I imagine it was a very different type of feel. Do you remember that day, Willie Green?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm 82 years old. Do I remember it? Yeah. Well, one thing about suffering, people who suffer learn to endure suffering, much like the children of Israel and Egypt. They had endured the suffering so long until they really had become desensitized to suffering. They were praying, asking the Lord to free them. But once they were free, they really didn't have no plan for freedom. And that's kind of what we're going through now. It saddens me to see peoples that take for so much for granted, especially voting, and really when it comes down to taking advantage of job opportunity. You know, sometimes I tell people that at my office, you know, go out to the school district, go out and apply. We have a great imbalance of minority administrators. Go put in your application. I'm not going to put. I'm no civil rights person. So you're really saying when you say that I have those scars in my forehead for naught, mm-hmm. You know. And so it's a lot of negativism that goes around within our own group that brings us to where we are today. And if people like Mr. Eady and myself sit down, the torch will go out. The wheel will roll backward. We got to keep moving. And it's unfortunate because, I mean, I retired from my business when I turned 65, so I guess that would be about 17, 18 years ago. And I figured I was going to go sit down. But when I looked and seen what was happening, I couldn't sit there. And each day I get up because I've got – and it's unfortunate that our adversaries benefit from my non-commitment and ignorance. Mm-hmm. And it's sad.
Well, Jared Eady, it sounds like the Black History Society here in Lee County is really working to sort of bridge mm-hmm. those sort of divides
right.
and make sure that the history and the experiences of folks like
sure.
Mr. Green don't get lost. I do apologize because we are out of time for today's show, but thank you both so much for joining us. Willie Green is a longtime Fort Myers resident and civil rights activist, former NAACP Lee County Chapter President and Southern Christian Leadership Conference local chapter president. He also started the Justice for All People Foundation. And Jared Eady is board chair of the Lee County Black History Society. They'll be holding a rededication ceremony on a Saturday. I think that'll be the final event for Black History Month.
Yes, sir. That's exactly right, John.
All right. Well, there is more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers, Richard Chinqui, Jessica Mazzaros, and Topher Forhez. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, and PR for Southwest Florida.